Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Bethany Morton. Morton is an assistant professor of history and women's studies at the University of Georgia in Athens, Georgia. She has written articles and done extensive research on the service economy and culture in this country, and she recently published a fascinating landmark book called To Serve God and Walmart, The Making of Christian Free Enterprise. It was published by Harvard University Press. I'm speaking to Bethany Morton by phone from Mississippi, where she is currently on tour with her book. Bethany Morton, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, prior to publishing your book, you obviously did much research into the service economy, and it was always with a focus on Walmart. Why the interest in this particular cultural, touchstone?
Well, it was a kind of confluence of events. I was looking for, at that point in your education where you're casting around for your dissertation topic, I was trying to find a single institution that would allow me to get at a number of these questions and yet keep a sort of narrative framework there. And so the analogy I was kind of thinking of on the one hand was like the Ford Motor Company for the first half of the 20th century really gave historians a way to look at not just an economic change that you have people working, for example, on an assembly line, in, an enormous factory complex, but it got much bigger than that. It allowed people to look at the way the industry was financed with vertical integration and stock sales and so forth that allowed us to look at things like how the sort of democratization of the ownership of a car changed all sorts of cultural experiences for people. It allowed us to look at immigration at that time, bringing people out of primarily Eastern and Southern Europe or out of African Americans out of the South and putting people for the first time into enormous factories and what that meant for all sorts of aspects of our collective national life. And so it seemed to me that we hadn't quite gotten a hold of the corresponding institution for the second half of the 20th century when more people worked in service. There were so many more women in waged jobs. When the Sun Belt and not what was now the Rust Belt was the engine of the economy, when international, this process that we somewhat fuzzily called globalization while that was going on, and that we needed something that really filled the same position as the Ford Motor Company. And all of a sudden, here was Walmart as the number one largest corporation on the planet. So it seemed like a good moment to
turn
our attention to it.
Uh-huh. Now, I understand you're from a small town called Oxford in Mississippi, and you saw how your small town changed when Walmart came in. Was that sort of the beginning of your interest in how this has affected change in our culture?
Well, it certainly, it was the background during my sort of adolescence as this town changed from having a downtown where you would go for the necessities of life to having what developers would call a kind of festival shopping zone where you go for entertainment and upscale shopping and the little size 2 cocktail dress. And if you wanted to have, if you wanted to shop for the things that people actually need day to day, suddenly you needed to take that process out to the edge of town. And I'm speaking right now from Oxford, as a matter of fact, which is a lovely place still, but which, for example, when I was a child, the downtown square in Oxford, the Courthouse Square, was a very integrated word we used to use back then, kind of a place. It was a public space. There is a courthouse. The grounds around the courthouse are public. There were activities that were not directly associated with consumption and commerce that went on in that space. When you move all those necessities of life, as Elizabeth Cohen has written about, into a private, an entirely private place that can only be accessed with a car that's under the control of a private owner, you've kind of removed one way that people interacted democratically, frankly. And that's kind of a shift for us all, that mirrors that larger privatization of our life, that we think of ourselves now as the viewing public or the consuming public in more situations than we used to. And the idea of a purely public, of a democratic public, has been undermined, I think, by the role that consumption plays in our lives.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. One thing that you brought up in your book that I found fascinating was the early days of chain stores in the 20s and 30s. There was a huge public outcry against chains, and I hadn't realized that. To talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, that really, when I started thinking, it was my father's suggestion that I look at Walmart possibly for this analysis. And when I started looking at it and thinking, okay, well, what might this tell us? One of the things that jumped out immediately was that Walmart was based, all its early growth and its roots were in exactly the same places that had led a national fight, not just against a large corporation, the kind of anti-monopolist populism from the turn of the century, but specifically against a large chain store or a series of chains. And so this, you know, from a historian's point of view, presents this interesting, and this is kind of the conundrum that Thomas Frank set up with What's the Matter with Kansas, that how is it that the parts of the country, literally the descendants in some cases of the people who fought against large corporate interests, who fought against specifically against chain stores and in favor of small-scale economic activity and more democratic control of the economy, what would get called socialism now, how is it that those same people became kind of the backbone of the conservative counter-revolution of the, you know, the last 30 or 40 years? And
Well, tell us how that did happen.
Well, if you look carefully at what's going on at the turn of the century in the 20s later with the fight against chain stores, is it's not so much, again, this is research by a historian, Charles Postel, that makes this really clear, Elizabeth Sanders, where they say, look carefully at what people are saying. They're asserting the right of citizens to control the economy, but they are not really opposed to large-scale companies. They just want to be in control of them. And so when you look at the Sun Belt economy in the second half of the 20th century, what you have is a change of ownership, not a change of structure so much. A company like Walmart, and very specifically Walmart in this case, promoted itself as being owned and controlled by people from here, as we say down here. You're not from here. Well, this was a company that was owned and run by people from here. More importantly, in its early stages, it was financed, its expansion was financed by having partnerships, so that one of the big critiques of chain stores coming out of these same areas, again, in the 20s and 30s, was if you let a chain store in, our young men are never going to be owners. They're never going to be in control of their destiny like they would have been, say, as a, you know, Jeffersonian farmer. They're never going to own and run a store. They're just going to be employees, which was kind of an effeminate, powerless position. And they're going to be in the employ of these distant financiers on Wall Street who own these chains through stock and so forth. And they're never going to be good democratic citizens. Well, what Walmart said was, you know, and again, this was because they needed capital for expansion, but they offered a plan. Sam Walton offered a plan to many people in this area, many young men, where he said, look, you don't have a big capital stake, but you can become a part owner in a Walmart. It's really kind of a franchise model, by putting up your work as a manager of it, and yet you'll own part of your store. And so he expanded on a model that actually preserved this kind of Jeffersonian independence, this sense that, you know, a real man eventually is in charge of his economic destiny by being an owner. And it was really a very clever move, and it kept the company growing through the 50s and 60s. It wasn't always called Walmart at that point. And so,
go ahead.
Well, it just responded to one of the critiques, or a number of the critiques in that populist moment, which is the ownership is what's important, and what's the problem for the South and for what becomes the Sun Belt is that it's always owned by people from a long way away who are not interested in the local. Well, Walmart was able to counter that argument very effectively.
Yeah, yeah. Now, throughout the 70s, Walmart became small-town life arenas in some ways, with RVs parked in the parking lots and so on. Was this part of their philosophy, or did this just sort of manifest out of the people who were participating in becoming workers at the store?
Well, you know, what I saw really was that a lot of the kind of hallmarks of Walmart culture, as, you know, it's very self-consciously called now.
Well, it is a culture.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But that it wasn't really brought in by forward-thinking people at the top, that there wasn't some sort of architectural plan of how we're going to build Walmart culture, that it was very much growth from the bottom as you bring people in this area into waged work. You know, these women who are now working in these service jobs, and then the men who are managers. That, for example, on the back of the company newsletter for many years, there were maps of what they started calling Walmart country. So there's this attempt to really make cohesive kind of mental geography of what is Walmart country. Well, what is Walmart country? Usually, in its early years, it meant a small town that nonetheless was, say, a county seat. It frequently had an outside source of income. So, for example, towns with military installations, with state colleges, schools for the blind, insane asylums, something that would bring public money in that would create, you know, a payroll and a customer base, you know, classically an army base was the place. So that kind of Sunbelt form of expansion that frankly just depends very heavily on public money but then turns it to private ends, that's one hallmark of Walmart country. It was also overwhelmingly white initially, and you have to kind of think about it to do that in the South. You have to be choosing particular counties that don't look back to a plantation economy as their basis. They were often where white settlers had small farms, and in the case, frankly, of Northwest Arkansas, where African Americans had been very dramatically driven out in the turn of the century. Not to say that, you know, this is a Walmart policy, but that the kind of mental geography of Walmart country was kind of the mental geography of country music. It's a particular country.
Yeah, you mentioned that. But you also talk in your book about how, especially in the 70s, the tone of the times, anti-Vietnam, a lot of chaos, and the people in Walmart represented their father's America, the whole concept and philosophy.
Yeah, that there's, you know, that strain of sort of Jeffersonian democracy that can really spin both ways. It can go to the left or go to the right, and that during that kind of silent majority, the sense that there's a little bit of an aggrieved white, small-time public who are really the backbone of the nation, who are really, when we say citizen, that's really somehow who we're talking about. When we say American, that's really who they mean. And that you can't really pass this story off in, say, Chicago or San Francisco or something in 1970, but in these interior parts of the country where people really could point to a sort of a long history of small independent farming, that it was possible to make yourself out to be this remnant, in a sense, and that this is the same identity that got built into, for example, to country music at the time, to the rise of the silent majority politically, and that there is very much a tone in a lot of this, that Walmart country, this kind of fictitious geography, you know, is the redoubt of some fundamental Jeffersonian virtues.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bethany Morton. We're talking about her book, To Serve God and Walmart, The Making of Christian Free Enterprise. Now, Bethany, before we do run out of time, let's talk about the evangelical culture that permeates Walmart. How did this rise up? Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, this was not a company that was founded by evangelical activists in any way. The original Walmart family, the Walton family, were pretty mainline, middle-of-the-road Protestants. And what you see in this area of the country is, as you see in many parts of the country during these years, is a revival, an evangelical revival, and the growth through people who work in hourly jobs, people then ultimately who work in management, that you see the evangelical revival being brought into the company, and the company increasingly identified as a kind of Christian space, to the point that even with the historic class action lawsuit for sex discrimination that's ongoing against Walmart, Dukes versus Walmart, you know, even people who would bring themselves to the point of suing the company for sex discrimination, you know, a basic feminist analysis of what's going on in a company like this, that even among those people, you will find people saying, look, I wanted to believe in this company because I'm a Christian and because I understood this company to be a Christian company, and I knew that I would be treated fairly at a Christian company. Now, on the left, that's a difficult statement to make sense of, because the assumption is that people working in low-wage jobs
with very little health insurance and overwork,
few benefits, and you know, and increasingly at a pace that's really not sustainable, that people like that are going to have a kind of left analysis of their working conditions, and it's not always the case. And the left has to seriously listen to, respectfully listen to people who say, as most women in America, when surveyed by labor organizations, say if the question is, where do you look for help when you have trouble in the job, the number one answer is, I turn to God. And that's not the same as saying I turn to a union or I turn to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission.
Bethany, did you actually interview people who told you
that? Absolutely.
Yeah, workers that told you these stories, that they thought of Walmart as a Christian company and so
and
on?
And who had a great deal of loyalty, even while they had a very clear critique that people would say, you know, you have to balance, and these are long-term employees. Mm-hmm. Women who were in the home region of Walmart, many of them had a quite different experience of working there than the typical experience you would have today. So I don't mean to suggest that this is somehow representative of the majority of employees. You know, the majority of employees leave Walmart within a year. They have enormous turnover. These were exceptional people in the sense that this was their life's work. But for that reason, because they are not turning around and suing the company, but instead were very clear that they wanted to be represented as supporters of the company, I thought it was really important to listen to what they had to say, because those are the people the left doesn't have an answer for. Mm-hmm. And what they would frequently say was, look, we're not stupid. We know what this wage works out to. It could have been a lot better. But look at the Ozarks in 1975, if you're a woman. You know, what exactly was the competition? They didn't have to be that good to, in terms of strict material interests. And what people would frequently talk about, and of course, all of us, you and your job, me and my job, we would talk about this as well, was the non-tangible rewards. And for a lot of people, among those was the sense of kind of Christian community, the sense of, you know, they're largely working around people that they know. They have a valued service role in the community. These are not...
And you mentioned that a lot of them felt like Walmart was a family.
Absolutely. You know, you take...
And Sam Walton actually kept that going while he was alive, too, didn't he?
Well, he was a very respected figure. You know, to live as he did in a reasonably frugal manner and with a great deal of kind of personal rectitude, you know, in classic kind of Protestant ethic terms, that's meaningful to a lot of people. And to see him as kind of a champion of the area and as someone who brings, if you will, the blessings of abundance to small towns that were not kind of in on this national orgy of consumption, to do it under the rubric of, we're going to help you serve your family, we're going to help you bring things for your family, not we're going to help you indulge yourself with sensual luxury, you would say at Macy's or something, but to say, no, we understand that the work of provisioning a family is hard work. It's also women's work, and we're going to try to make it easier for you. You know, we can poke holes in that all day long, but you can't deny that there is a difference and a certain amount of respect for people's day-to-day work that comes along with that. And many people saw him as a really exemplary figure and felt personal loyalty to him that carried over to the company, and that's not irrational.
No. Well, he came off as a father figure.
Absolutely. He was very successful at, and remember, you're talking about an area where, unlike, say, in Chicago or
San Francisco.
You're not taking people off of farms and running them through factory discipline. You're bringing a whole different workforce into waged work. You're taking people who, you know, in the Ozarks, people were still working on family farms in the 40s and 50s, and it was those people who moved straight from farms pretty much into service work and brought with them the kinds of traditions that made sense in the area. Farm families are frequently working for kind of mutual survival, not individual success, or they're used to the idea that you would do a lot of different jobs at different points in your life or even different points in the year.
And then they were also used to the fact that males would be managers and females would be service-oriented,
absolutely.
Right? I mean, that was part of the evangelical flavor as well.
Well, and this was what I found so fascinating was, on the one hand, this kind of headship and submission model that the man is the head of the family and women should submit to him, which comes, you know, directly from the New Testament, but which received a great deal more, shall we say, theological emphasis in evangelical Christianity after the early 1970s. So suddenly headship and submission have a much greater role to play in evangelical revival than they used to. And at the same time, you see service workplaces like Walmart kind of latching on to this idea of what they call servant leadership, that men will in fact embody these very feminine values of service and patience and helping other people, that that's going to be how we distinguish a real leader, is he's a man who's good at women's work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not the same as putting women in control of anything or rewarding women financially and with benefits and so forth, but it is a distinct change in your work culture to have the virtues that you, say, as a 45-year-old mother of three who's working in a Walmart day in and day out, to have your virtues and your skills held up as the important ones, as key for management as well as for hourly workers. I don't get that at my workplace.
Yeah, that's very interesting that when you talked about that in your book, yeah.
And it's being held up in a pulpit and said, you know, that men, these same men, when they come home, they had better embody these kind of feminine virtues at home. They had better be involved in their family. They better appreciate the work of service that their wives are doing. And when they go back to the store, says, for example, the Walmart director of marriage and family living, you know, the idea that there is such a role within a multinational corporation is kind of mind-boggling.
It is.
He was.
Yep,
and
yep.
He's telling you, the male manager now in the early 80s, he's saying, when you go home, you should honor and appreciate your wife's service at home. And when you go to work, you should take that same kind of Christian appreciation for service to the women who work for you. Now, you know, you can call it false consciousness, but we all look for these non-tangible rewards at work, and it would be a salutary development in a lot of workplaces,
mm-hmm,
if someone would say, you know, these virtues of service and patience and consideration for other people are the key virtue, and we're going to try our best to hold them up and to make them a requirement for management. You know, that's not an inconsiderable victory, particularly
right,
when it pays off at home as well.
Right, right. Now I want to talk about this. In the early 1990s, Walmart took the first step of incorporating food operations in many of its super centers.
Exactly.
How has this changed the culture of food in this country? Did you come up with any hypothesis about that?
Well, I have to say, I mean, there's so much good scholarship right now on the role of food. Even my own colleague, Shane Hamilton, I think is working right now on new books on this. That what I saw instead was from within Walmart, how the addition of grocery changed the culture of the company really drastically. And the thing was, it actually almost perfectly coincided with the passing of Sam Walton himself, so that when you get a lot of people looking back at their, you know, many decades at the company, they'll say, oh, well, everything changed in the early 90s. One way to read that is, well, the founder with all his virtues was gone and it could change. But the way they frequently pointed it to was, we went to a 24-hour a day model. We brought in tons of people from outside. You know, Walmart grew out of the dime store tradition. That's a particular culture in,
yes,
in economics.
Mm-hmm.
Grocery was a very different one. So a lot of people would say this was the turning point for the company, and it had a lot to do with taking on a completely different retail culture and moving to many more people, many more hours, a much faster pace, even tighter margins. Grocery is works on very slim margins.
And this is also changing the way food is produced in this country, too, but that's another subject, I would say.
The sort of industrial production and, mm-hmm, distribution of food has been, but what's interesting about that is how much that move was promoted on the left in the 20s and 30s when it gets rolling, how much it was seen as part of a rationalization, a modern, forward-thinking kind of development that would ultimately benefit everyone and would raise wages in retail, for example,
mm-hmm,
would automatically improve people's conditions, that, you know, the nation in the 20s is laughing at rural Christians in Arkansas who object to this development. The Nation magazine, you know, the sort of standard bearer for the kind of middle-of-the-road labor left in this country, was saying, you silly people, you know, you're just as confused as you were at the monkey trial, the Scopes trial. You are standing in the the path of history and progress by insisting that there ought to be small farms and small stores. Mm. If you would just get with the program, you would understand that when we have this kind of industrial distribution of food and other good and necessary items, that everyone will be better off, that wages will automatically rise, that managers, enlightened managers, will see how much better everything would work with good wages and benefits and so forth, and all that stuff will happen automatically if you people would just get out of the way. And so here, you know, here are these same people, their descendants, a generation or two down the line, you know, they had the critique that you now hear from the kind of slow food movement and that similar progressive responses to this industrial food. The critique before was coming from the, you know, the purportedly irrational rural Christians.
Bethany, we only have a couple minutes left. I want to ask you one final question in regard to this subject. Do you think Walmart has been good or bad for our culture? Have you come up with any ideas in that respect?
I mean, obviously, I'm a critic of an international economy that has produced such vicious inequality, injustice. I am not in any way a champion of this neoliberal model that is part and parcel of Walmart's success. Walmart didn't create it. It is the creature of our joint abdication of responsibility that says we will turn money over, public money, in the form of subsidy to enormous multinational corporations like Walmart or Goldman Sachs, and yet we will abdicate the responsibility for setting the rules by which they can use our money. You can't expect as Michael Moore used to say in that great little essay of his from a decade or so ago, if the bottom line really is the bottom line, if, you know, business is an end in itself and its only logic is what makes the greatest profit, well, then why don't we let, he used to say, General Motors manufacture crack? And you could say, why don't we let Walmart sell crack if really making a profit is a justification in itself? Well, obviously, we put rules on economic behavior. You can make a lot of money selling your children, but we don't let anyone do that if we can stop it, unless they're in Guatemala, apparently, in which case we turn a blind eye. But we get to set those rules, and it's our responsibility to set those rules and to expect entities that we have legally structured so that their prime responsibility is shareholder value, to expect them to somehow put brakes on themselves while we feed them public subsidies in the forms of, you know, food stamps for the employees that they don't pay enough to live on, or tax holidays for 10 years. You know, if we enable that, then we can't be surprised at the outcome. But what you can't do is look at people who inhabit that system and somehow say that if they would all just get their act together and go to Restoration Hardware and stop having such tacky consumer tastes, they would then we'd all be better off. It has to be at the level of our own mutual democratic responsibility for the political economy.
Bethany, we have run out of time. Can you give a contact information real quick?
My contact information?
Yeah.
I teach at the University of Georgia. I'm on our website there in the History Department or the Women's Studies Department, and of course I'm always delighted to try to continue the conversation.
That's great.
My students will tell you I'm kind of slow on electronic communication. But
that's okay. Well, we hope people will get in touch with you. Again, the book is called To Serve God and Walmart, The Making of Christian Free Enterprise. Bethany Morton, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.